If we are all here, it's because we are all interested in non-commutative geometry, and more specifically, its application to particle physics. It gives us a very nice way to unify in the same geometrical framework a standard model with gravity. Okay, I have to apologize in advance. The talk might be pedantic at some point because I didn't know who would be in the audience, so I included some basics as well as some more advanced stuff. Okay. So, we had this nice geometrical framework to unify standard model and gravity, but it has two issues. First, it's a purely Riemannian theory for the moment. And the second issue is that it's still classical. It is not a quantum theory yet. So, when trying to solve these two issues, one might get interested in the differential graded algebra of non-commutative geometry in non-commutative differential forms. They're interesting because first you can use them to express all, not all, but most of the physically interesting quantities such as gauge fields or the Lagrangian, etc. And it's also interesting because you can use it to solve the second issue, the quantization issue, using, for example, the Batalin-Wilkowski formalism. Okay, but I will not talk about all of that. Okay, this is just to say that we got interested into the differential graded algebras for these reasons, and then this led us to Latham and Shane's paper, which talk about this differential graded algebra of non-commutative differential forms, and added some structure to it. So we found that really interesting. We tried to build on it and complete it in a way. And our main result here is that the structure of the differential algebra and its representation can be used to deduce some constraints on the theory resulting from all of this. And already on the classical level, which means you don't need to quantize the theory to get constraints. Okay? And at the end of the talk, I'll also be talking about the Lorentzian issue. Okay, I'll start with a short reminder of how we get the standard model from non-commutative geometry. Then I will show how Latham and Shane rewrote the axioms of non-commutative geometry applied to physics. It's what we call the spectral model. Then, again, a short reminder of non-commutative geometry, specifically what the algebra of non-commutative differential forms looks like. Then, and this is the main point of the talk, I will show you how we try to represent this algebra on a graded space. Try to induce the correct structure on the algebra, and how we can recover the standard model from that. And then, as I told you before, a little thing about the Lorentzian case. Okay, first things first, a short reminder of what the spectral model is. I'm sorry if this is boring for some of you. our essential data, what we need is first an algebra. It's an evolutive algebra, which is the algebraic equivalent of the space we'll be working on. This algebra helps us define a non-commutative manifold that generalizes commutative manifolds. We represent this algebra on some Hilbert space, okay? And then we've got these three operators that act on the Hilbert space. The first one is the Dirac operator that contains the metric structure of your space. This is defined in analogy with the usual Dirac operator we have in particle physics, which is gamma mu d mu, the one we have in the Dirac equation. Then you've got your gradient operator, the axon Hilbert space, which is defined in a similar way to your chirality. And then you've got the antinomial isometry defined similarly to the charge conjugation operator. Okay, you've got these operators, and then you've got constraints on these operators. You've got the following axioms. They either have to commute or anti-commute with epsilon prime and epsilon second signs. They're not entirely arbitrary. And you've got these two conditions, which are called conditions of order 0 and 1, respectively. They are commutation conditions of either an element of the algebra or its commutator with the Dirac operator with some element of what we call the opposite algebra. You can obtain the opposite algebra by applying this operation to your elements of the algebra. A, B are elements of the algebra. I forgot to say that, sorry. So we've got this opposite operation here, defined using the a joint operation on the Hilbert space and the anti-neural isometry. It's very important. Okay, so we've got these conditions. And now I will show you, remind you of what the spectral triple of the standard model looks like. I'm going to show some, I'm going to show this part explicitly because we're going to need it for some calculations. Okay, it's first we start with what we call the commutative spectral triple or canonical spectral triple. This is the one that is used to define, in general, what a spectral triple should look like. All these axioms come from this example, from this commutative spectral triple, with your algebra being an algebra of smooth functions on some spin manifold. Your Hilbert space is just spinners. Dirac operator is the covariant generalization of the Dirac operator that we know from the Dirac equation. And then the chirality and anti-neural isometry are just chirality and charge conjugation. Okay, so this defines the gravity part of your model. We need the gauge theory part. And for this, you need this finite spectral triple, which, when tensored with this commutative spectral triple, produces the full, almost commutative spectral triple of the standard model. This defines the commutative manifold. This defines a sort of finite space on each point of this manifold, and the result is this non-commutative manifold. So you tensor everything except the Dirac operator, which is a linear combination of the two Dirac operators, tensored by either the identity or the chirality. Okay, a short reminder of how we interpret this data. You've got your Dirac operator, which contains two parts. The first one is the commutative Dirac operator, which generates the coupling constants as well as the gauge fields of your theory. Then you've got the finite Dirac operator here, which will generate the mass terms that includes the Higgs fields and Majorana mass terms. And your Hilbert space, so all the bosons are in the Dirac operator, okay? And your Hilbert space will contain the fermions. And okay, so this is pretty clear. Now we need to define the finite spectral triple. Let me just remind you that these two spectral triples are both exactly spectral triples. They both have to obey the axioms that define a spectral triple. And if you have that, then this will obviously be a spectral triple, as long as the spin manifold here has the correct dimension. We usually take a four-dimensional Riemannian spin manifold. Okay, so the finite part. Okay, so this is only for one generation of fermions. We have not done this yet for three generations. We're working on it. Your finite algebra is the sum of three algebras, three real algebras, complex numbers, quaternions, and 3x3 complex matrices. You can see the resemblance, the similarity with the gauge group of the standard model. There is a correspondence. Okay, so this will give us the bosons, and the Hilbert space will give us the fermions. It's the sum of four spaces. The first one is right particles, then there are left particles, then right antiparticles, then left antiparticles. Obviously, you've got eight right particles, two leptons, six quarks, two quarks times three colors. Okay, with this data, and you can then prove that there exists a basis in which your gradient operator and your anti-linear isometry look like this. So you can see that these signs here correspond to the correct chirality, or its opposite, depending on your convention. And your anti-linear isometry is indeed a charge conjugation because it exchanges particles and antiparticles. OK, this is the representation. I will not be giving too many details about it, but you can see that all the data you need about the standard model is encoded in the representation. For example, you've got the representation of this number here, this element of the algebra. It's a complex number, a quaternion, and a 3x3 matrix. And you can see here that the phase of the complex number determines or corresponds to the hypercharge of the fermion that it applies to. Okay? And you can see, for example, that the quaternion, which would correspond to the SU2 part of your model, acts only on left particles, et cetera, et cetera. So this is how you get the representation, anyway. This is not important. What is interesting is what happens when you use this data and these axioms here to determine what the most general Dirac operator should look like. If you apply your commutation relations and your zeros and first order conditions, you get this form for the Dirac operator. It's parameterized by two matrices. The first one is this matrix here, Y. It's a Yukawa matrix. It basically contains all your Yukawa couplings and will generate the Yukawa mass terms, the one with the Higgs field in it. And you've got this matrix here, this M matrix, which looks like this. So it contains 8 complex numbers. One of them will generate the Majorana mass term for the right neutrino. The other ones are unwanted because they simply do not appear in the standard model. It does not correspond to empirical evidence. So we want to get rid of them. How do you do that? Well, there is a way. You could, for example, impose this massless photon condition. You have this finite subalgebra of the finite algebra, and if you ask that the Dirac operator commute with it, the finite Dirac operator, then the solution is that B, C, and D have to vanish. So this massless photon condition ensures that these mass terms vanish, which ensures that the photon is massless. So this corresponds to the standard model with a seesaw mechanism, because you get the Majorana mass term, it is not vanishing. But there is another way to do this. And this can be done by rewriting the axioms that define your spectral triple. You need actually constraints on the differential algebra of non-commutative forms. And this is what Latham and Shane here did. So basically, what they proved, I'm going to say it in another way. For all practical purposes, this is equivalent to what is in your paper, guys. But to make the transition easier to what we did in our paper, I'm going to rephrase it differently, OK? If that's OK. OK. So basically, by asking that H be a bimodule over the Hilbert space be a bimodule over with the differential algebra, what you get is that the conditions of order 0, 1 are not axioms anymore. You can derive them. You can prove them from some more fundamental axioms. And you get a new condition of order 2 that replaces the massless photon condition. OK, obviously need to define now what is this differential algebra. It's not the differential algebra of non-commutative forms, not yet. For now, it's just the universal differential algebra associated to our algebra. It's just generated by the elements of the algebra and the differentials and the following relations. And of course, it's a graded space because you can count the number of differentials in each element. And you can represent it on your Hilbert space using the Dirac operator. Because the commutator of any element of the Dirac, of the algebra with the Dirac operator is obviously a derivation. So maybe you can use this to represent the differentials. And indeed, this is what is done traditionally in non-commutative geometry. You represent, for example, A0 with its representation and dA1 with its commutator with D, et cetera. OK, so now we've got our differential algebra. Its representation. Now we want to, we know how to represent it on Hilbert space, and we'll see why H should be a bimodule over the differential algebra. First, a short reminder of what modules are and bimodules. A module over a ring simply generalizes what a vector field is over a field. A vector space is over a field. It's the same defining relations. You've got your linearity, distributivity, etc. But the difference between a ring and a field is that the ring is not necessarily abelian. Your elements do not commute. So the order in which you multiply is important. So you can define either a left module or a right module. The left module has a left action. If you apply r prime, then r is equivalent to applying r prime. This is what we do usually. Then there is this little counterintuitive thing called the right action that defines the right module. If you multiply by r, then r prime, then it's acting with r prime r. So you see it's inverted. Okay, so we can define left modules, right modules. A module can be both left and right. And if your left and right actions are compatible and have some form of satisfy some form of associativity condition, then you get what we call a bimodule. Okay, so this is what a bimodule is. Now we'll see what the Hilbert space is. I'm sorry? Did I get it wrong? You mean here? It's R prime R. Really? What did I write? Wait. Just a second. No, wait. Yeah, this multiplication here is the multiplication of the algebra. So. You mean? Wait, how do you interpret it? Wait a second. I'm sorry. I just need to focus a bit here. I'm a bit lost. R prime. Oh. Okay. I think it's clear to everyone what I wanted to write, so it's okay. Yeah, as long as the interpretation is okay, we're all okay. Sorry about the typo. So we've got our definition of what a bimodule is. Let's go back to the differential algebra. What do you need? Oh. Here.
If you had written it like this, would you guys agree with it?
If you write that.
Okay, now I'm really confused. This is not the right action, it's the representation of. What do you call a right action exactly? I think we're not. Yeah, sure. No, I'm not sure we agree on what the definition of the right action is, but okay. Can I go on now? Or? Okay, so now we will try to define a left and right action of the differential algebra on the Hilbert space. The left action is just the usual action because you've got a representation, so that helps you define. What? I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
The thing I wrote on the board is crap, I agree with that.
No, it's not crap, it's actually the right way to define left right action because it needs to exchange the elements, so. Yeah, the opposite, not. They're related anyway. So the left action is just the usual action because you've got a representation, it acts on the left. And then you want to define a right action. And surprisingly, we can do that using what you have at our disposal in the spectral triple. To define a right action, you need an operation that is linear in differential form omega, and that exchanges the order of the elements, just like here. So if you want to exchange the order of your elements, what you can use is the involution, the adjoint operation, But that's antilinear. To make it linear again, you have to use the antilinear isometry. So this is what you need, and this is exactly what you have in a spectral triple. It's like the spectral triple is big enough for definition of a right action. So using the left action, you can make the Hilbert space a left module of the differential algebra, and using the right action, you can make it a right module. Now, if you use your order zero condition, you can see pretty easily that the Hilbert space is an AA bimodule. If you use both the order 0 and 1 conditions, then your Hilbert space is an omega AA bimodule as well as an A omega A bimodule. Because, I'll just go back to the order 0 and 1 conditions. This tells you that the elements and their opposites commute, and this tells you that the elements and their differentials commute. So since the differential algebra is generated by scalars and their differentials, it tells you that any element of the algebra commutes with the opposite of any differential form. So the Hilbert space is an omega AA bimodule, and obviously it's an A omega A bimodule. So the next logical step, the logical thing to do is just to ask for H to be an omega A bimodule. And if you do this, the associativity condition gives you this. So you need all differential forms to commute with all opposite differential forms. And since all differential forms are generated with scalars and differentials, you can break this down to four equivalent conditions. Okay, the first one is the order zero condition. You obtain it with using two scalars. The second and third one are equivalent as they are the order one condition that you get by using a differential and a scalar. The last condition that you get by using two differentials is this new order two condition. You see this, if you apply this new order two condition to the Dirac operator of the finite part of the standard model, you find four solutions. So it's an equation, see? Well, it's not exactly an equation, but it's a set of equations because your elements A and B are arbitrary. And trying to solve these equations, you find four solutions. And one of these solutions is physically interesting because it makes the parameters, the unwanted parameters B, C, and D vanish. So you can recover the finite part of the standard model with the seesaw mechanism. But sadly, it does not work in the commutative case. Because if you compute this, for example, this DF with DG opposite, the opposite of DG is just its opposite, literally. Just put a minus sign there. So it gives you minus these two commutators, and you get this quantity here. And obviously, this matrix is non-zero, and these are arbitrary in a way. So what you get is generally non-vanishing quantity. So the order two condition does not apply to the commutative spectral triple. You have your order zero, order one condition, but the order two condition does not work. Well, we can make it work. You can make it work by first representing your differential algebra not on a single Hilbert space, but on a graded space, and by also taking into account, by using the correct differential algebra, which is not the universal differential algebra, but the universal differential algebra of non-commutative geometry. So we need to define it first. Short reminder of what it is. We start with the universal DGA, okay? Then we represent it in a graded way. OK, this might be a bit confusing, but this is actually what Kahn does in his book. Alan Kahn does this, except that he does not make it explicit that the representation is graded. But it's implicit. It's obviously graded. It has to be. So we define explicitly this graded representation of the universal differential graded algebra. You map each component of the graded algebra to a copy of the bounded operators on the Hilbert space, okay? And each differential form is represented using the usual, each homogeneous differential form is represented using the usual representation. This is just the usual representation, the traditional one with the Dirac operator, but except that this time you keep track of the gradient of your elements. That's the only difference, okay? The problem with this representation is that it's not differential. You can have differential forms with vanishing representation, but with a non-vanishing representation of their differential. Physically, this corresponds to fields with zero vanishing potential but non-vanishing field strength. And this is bad. We do not want that. So we need to get rid of differential forms that look like this and that have this property. So we need to remove what we call the junk parts of the algebra. You start by defining, using the kernel of representation, obviously, because we want to get rid of the differential forms with vanishing representation. But then we want to get rid of their differentials as well. They have to vanish. So you add to your junk, space here, you add to it its differential. And then you obviously do not need to add the differential of differential because that's zero. So you just need this. This is a junk. It's a differential graded ideal of the algebra. So you can quotient the algebra out. You can quotient out the junk from the algebra. And you end up with this, which is the algebra of non-commutative differential forms. It's the quotient of both. And let me show you an example of what it looks like. For example, in the commutative case, for a commutative spectral triple, consider this differential form here. It has vanishing representation because the representation of the scalar function f is a scalar which commutes with the representation of dg. So obviously, the differential of omega should be in the junk. And its differential is just the anticommutator of df and dg. So this should be vanishing up to the junk. So you see, these two differentials anticommute. And this is exactly what you have with traditionally with differential forms defined over some manifold. But this works. And you can show that the differential algebra coincides with the algebra of differential forms on some spin manifold. So this is the correct way to build and construct the differential algebra of non-commutative forms. You have to take into account the junk. So we're going to do this to make sure our order two condition works for the commutative spectral triple. And hopefully, if it works for the commutative one, it will work for the almost commutative one. But it's not enough. We have to do more. We need something else. The fact is you have a differential algebra. And when you have a differential algebra, a differential graded algebra, it's better to represent it on a graded space. So this is what we're going to do. We're going to represent the algebra of non-commutative forms over some differential graded bimodule. Well, you can drop this assumption here that it's differential. The important part is that the bimodule be graded. The grading works this way, just like for any graded algebra. If you take an element of some ring R, some graded ring R of degree I, and make it act on some element of degree J of some graded bimodule, it has to give you an element of degree I plus J of your module. This is, for example, for a left module. You see, it's pretty similar to what we have with algebras. But this is for representation, so it's a ring acting on a module. Here is a very simple example. For example, you can consider this space, which is a sum of copies of a Hilbert space, a countable sum. And this is a graded left module over this space here that I defined before. Here, for the representation of the differential algebra, it's the sum of bounded operators. It's a countable sum of copies of the algebra of bounded operators on a Hilbert space. So obviously, these algebras can act on these spaces. They're the same, using the usual canonical action of operators on a space. And you could, for example, make the nth copy act on the nth copy here. But that does not give you a graded module. What we do here is to make the mth copy act on the nth space, and then this maps the product to the m plus nth space. So it's just the usual action, but you use this gradient, OK? OK, so we've got this left action, for example, of this algebra on this space. And we know that we can represent the algebra, the universal DGA, in this algebra here, in a graded way. So we can combine this with the representation to turn, and this is just an example, to turn this space into a graded left module over the differential algebra. You just combine both. You see, the representation of the differential x on the vector, you've got the left action, and this defines a grade, this makes this h infinity a graded left module over the differential algebra. This is just an example. You can also make it a graded right module using the opposite operation. Okay. Now, we will not be using this for two reasons. First, this is the universal DGA. You have to take into account the junk. And the second reason, I'll come to it later. Okay. So you can define graded left modules, graded right modules, and you can obviously define graded bimodules. That would just be a graded left and right module with some compatibility between the left and right actions. Okay, now I'm going to assume that we have a very special graded bimodule with the left and right actions related by some opposite operation, such as the one here on the blackboard, which has to invert the order of your elements and has to be linear. So this opposite operation maps the algebra or the ring to some opposite algebra or ring that acts the same way as the algebra on your module using the left action, okay? And you can use this to define a right action. And what happens is usually that if you want this representation of your algebra on some graded bimodule to be well-defined, the left and right actions have to be related by this formula here. There might be some other sign, but these other signs are not important. They only depend on the degree of either M or R. The important sign is the one that depends on both. And you see, it's the parity of the product of their degrees. Okay, so this is what happens when you represent the algebra, a graded algebra on a graded space. Let's see what happens if you use this on the algebra of non-commutative forms. Okay, I told you we needed to get to take into account the junk. So you have, for example, your algebra, your universal DGA. You need to quotient out by its junk. Problem is, now we're making it act using on some Hilbert space, on some graded version of the Hilbert space, for example, using both a left and a right action. We need to take that into account. Hopefully, fortunately, we have this. We have a correspondence between the left and the right actions. So you can just use that to move your right action to the left. So you work with, instead of working with left and right actions, you work with the algebra and its opposite. And so you have to define an algebra that is the algebra generated by both the differential algebra and its opposite. And this is a subalgebra of this algebra here. And then you need to take into account the junk and quotient it out. You have to quotient the junk out of the differential algebra, and obviously to quotient the opposite of the junk out of the opposite of the differential algebra. So you have to consider the differential graded ideal generated by both the junk and its opposite. And this is the differential graded ideal of B. So what you do is consider this quotient, B quotiented by K. This is a differential algebra of non-commutative forms we'll be using. That takes into account, obviously, the fact that you have both a left and a right action. Then you need to represent it on a graded bimodule. Now, what you could have done is use this, for example, here, because you have omega A that acts on H infinity, and then you take the quotient of B by K. So what you could do is represent this algebra here on the quotient of this space by the junk acting on the space itself. This is a way to do it. So you build, you construct a quotient of your Hilbert space to represent a quotient of your algebra. This is what is usually done. But we run into a small issue. The space is most of the time too small. For example, in the commutative case, what happens is that the second component of your space simply vanishes. This is not good. We would like a space with non-vanishing components. So we decided that the simplest and most obvious thing to do to get a sufficiently large space to represent a graded algebra is to represent it on itself. So our graded bimodule is the algebra itself. Okay? It's the algebra itself. You need to define left and right actions. Your left action will be the usual action up to equivalence classes, up to the junk. And as for the right action, you need to use the opposite operation, and obviously you need to take into account this sign here, so it appears here. So you've got your left and right actions. Now we ask that this graded left and right module be a bimodule. So the compatibility of the left and right actions gives you this condition here. It's pretty similar to what Latham and Shane found. There are two small differences. First, obviously, because this is all defined up to equivalence classes, this is zero up to the junk. It's not always vanishing. And the second difference is obviously this sign here that comes from this sign. So this is not always a commutator. It can be an anti-commutator as well. Depends on the degree of your differential forms. Once again, this can be broken down to four conditions. The first three conditions, you get them by replacing here your differential forms by either scalars, a scalar and a scalar, or a scalar and a differential, which makes this sign disappear. So it's just a commutator. And this junk here will be of order either 0 or 1. And these two components, these first two components of the junk vanish. So you get vanishing commutators. These are just the order 0 and 1 conditions. We recover the usual conditions. And we get a new order 2 condition. This time you have an anti-commutator because we have two differentials, degree 1, 1 times 1. And this anti-commutator has to vanish up to the second component of the junk. Okay, so we know what the order 0 and 1 conditions do. We know how they work. Now let's see what this new order 2 condition does. As an example, let's see what happens in the commutative case. So you've got this anti-commutator here of the differential f and the opposite of the differential of g. So this is minus the anti-commutator of df and dg. It's minus the representation. And we know that this is in the junk. So this is 0 up to the junk. And now the order 2 condition works for the spectral triple. So we've got something that works for the commutative spectral triple. You've got your order 0 condition, order 1, and your order 2 condition as well. So if this works for the commutative spectral triple, maybe it works for the almost commutative spectral triple that defines the standard model. So let's apply this to the standard model. We're going to do this sequentially. I'll start with the order 0 condition. OK, we know that the order 0, 1, 2 conditions work for the commutative spectral triples. If you apply your order 0 condition to the almost commutative spectral triple of the standard model, this implies that the order 0 condition has to work for the finite part. So you get the order 0 condition for the finite part. If you then apply the order 1 condition to the full spectral triple, you get the order 1 condition for the finite part. Now, what we need to do is apply the order 2 condition to the full spectral triple. And what happens is that you get an order 2 condition for the finite part, but it is not the order 2 condition. It's not this condition here. It's something slightly different. See, it's the anticommutator vanishing up to some space I, which is not the order 2 junk. This happens because our junk is generated using the junk and its opposite. The usual junk can be decomposed using tensor products. It has a very simple expression for the almost commutative spectral triple. But if you build this junk here, generated by the junk and its opposite, sometimes they interfere and you get additional terms. For example, here our space I contains the order 2 finite junk. Okay, so these last two terms correspond to the order 2 finite superjunk, what we call KF2. And this term here comes from an interference between this term here and this one here. So you've got more terms than you should have. Anyway, all we need to do now is solve this equation, okay? We're not going to solve it exactly. It would be crazy. Maybe we can try and find some necessary condition for this to be true. Then we'll prove that it's sufficient. And you can do this by writing the matrix form of these two quantities explicitly. This shows the non-zero matrix elements of your anticommutator and your space I, okay? It's not as complicated as it seems. The black dots represent the non-zero elements of the anticommutator of the finite order two condition, and the colored circles correspond to the non-zero elements of the space I. So you can see pretty clearly that they do not overlap. I think it's clear. I'm not sure. Anyway, they do not overlap, which means that if this anticommutator vanishes up to the space I, it simply has to vanish. It cannot be in the space. It has to be vanishing. So it is necessary to have this, and obviously it is sufficient. So the order two condition for the finite part is exactly this. It's simply the previous order two condition, but with an anticommutator instead of a commutator. And as it turns out, this equation has the same solutions as the previous one. You get four solutions, with only one of them being of any physical interest. So now the previous construction of Lathman chain works, but now it works for the full standard model, which includes the commutative part and not just the finite part. Okay, so now we've got something that helps us recover the standard model with CSAW mechanism, the full standard model. To conclude this talk, maybe a little something about what it tells us about the Lorentzian formulation, or a potential Lorentzian formulation of the spectral model. What happens usually when you go from the Riemannian case to the Lorentzian one is that you have to add a Krein structure to a Hilbert space. It is much more natural to use a Krein space when you're working in the Lorentzian case. You need to define a fundamental symmetry here, which is a unitary self-adjoint operator, that turns your Hilbert space product into an indefinite scalar product. This is quite normal. For example, in the commutative spectral triple, we know from particle physics that the most natural product to use is this one. The product of two spinners would be the integral of the, for example, here, psi and phi. It would be the integral of psi bar times phi. So it's the adjoint of psi times I gamma naught times phi. So this I gamma naught here corresponds to the fundamental symmetry we have to use to to relate the Hilbert space product to the Krein space product. Now, obviously, if you're using Krein space, if you have an indefinite scalar product, you need to define a different adjoint because you have a different product. And since both products are related by the fundamental symmetry, the usual Hilbert adjoint and the Krein adjoint are related by the fundamental symmetry as well. So you have this relation here. The Krein adjoint is simply the fundamental symmetry times the usual adjoint times the fundamental symmetry again. And as an axiom, we assume that the Dirac operator is Krein anti-self-adjoint, because once again, in the commutative case, this is what happens to the Dirac operator. So this is one of the axioms we use to define here what a Lorentzian spectral triple should be like. Okay, so remember, we also have an algebra, and it's represented on our Hilbert space, which is now a Krein space. And the algebra is involutive, and its representation should be involutive. But which involution should we use? Should we represent the adjoint of the differential forms by the Hilbert adjoint of the representation, or should we represent the adjoint of the differential form by the Krein adjoint of its representation? Well, the order two condition tells us which one we should choose. This is very interesting. If you assume that the Hilbert space structure is more fundamental, and you use the Hilbert adjoint to represent the adjoint of the form, then the order two condition does not work anymore. But if you use the Krein adjoint, then the order two condition works again. And you see, I did not use at any point the fact that we have a Krein space, okay? I just used information about what the charge conjugation should be in the commutative case. And this has nothing to do with the Hilbert space being Krein or not. It's a purely algebraic condition. You see here in the commutative case, the order two condition tells us that we should have something that is Krein and not Hilbert. And obviously, you can apply this to the full standard model with your full almost commutative spectral triple. And you need to define a fundamental symmetry for your spectral triple. So it's just the fundamental symmetry of the commutative part, and you tensor it with the identity on the finite part. We keep the finite part Riemannian. We do not make it Lorentzian or anything like that. We could, but we do not need to. And you need to modify the definition of your antilinear isometry if you want your spectral triple to be a spectral triple. You have to add the gradient of the finite part here. It's not just the tensor of the two antilinear isometries. If you do this and if you apply this to the standard model, you get a Lorentzian standard model with seesaw mechanism, and you get exactly the same thing here, the same equation for the finite Dirac operator, and once again the same solutions, etc. Okay, so I'm going to conclude now. Basically, by representing the differential algebra of non-commutative forms on some graded bimodule, you get constraints on your theory, you get constraints on your Dirac operator, a constraint that helps you get closer to the standard model with seesaw mechanism, and you also get constraints on any potential Lorentzian formulation of your theory. It tells you what the representation of that theory should be like, etc. And this is just at the classical level. So we started by asking questions about how we could quantize this theory, and by trying to understand the algebra of non-commutative forms for that specific purpose, we already got constraints and results on the classical level. I hope you enjoyed this long talk. Thank you for your attention. Any questions? Yes?
Does this make a prediction that the three domains are Majorana?
I'm sorry, couldn't hear you.
Does it make a prediction whether the neutrino is a Majorana particle or a Dirac particle?
I'm sorry. I can't. Let me just get closer to you.
Does the question whether the neutrino is a Majorana neutrino?
Yeah, Majorana. Majorana neutrinos. Well, yeah. I do not know. I haven't studied the model thoroughly, but I can tell you that this gives you Majorana neutrinos, and that's it. That's all I know. Sorry. One of the authors of the model is here. You should ask her the question. No questions, really. Oh, you said it. The room, it's doesn't make people want to ask questions, huh?
I have a question that I feel like is going to be more easily asked after. Could be hard to hash out better, but it's about what, how much the result relies on the module being the same as the.
That's a good question. It's obviously not the unique choice, but it's the simplest one. But the results do not depend too much on the space, as long as it's large enough to give you the equation and to make sure it's not degenerate or trivial. So it's either trivial or that. If your space is too small, the equation might be trivial. If your space is large enough, it's what we saw. So there aren't that many possibilities. Is that it's too small. In yeah, it makes it trivial. That's not good. So we're not sure about what space we should use to represent the algebra. We're not sure yet, but we're working on it because we do not know simply what properties it should have. We're not even sure if it should be a differential space or not, for example. We know it has to be graded by module, but differential or not differential, we're not sure. So we're trying to put some extra structure on it, and then we'll see what happens with these extra constraints.